welcome to our spoiler review for episode 7 of Shogun here on the Outlaw Nation channel. You all have been following us every week, and we're picking up more and more people every week who are discovering our reviews for Shogun, and we very much appreciate it. I am the Outlaw John Rocha, joined as always by my friend in Shogun love, but also a well-versed James Clavell historian, and who has been has done an incredible job over the last few weeks comparing the book to the series and giving us a whole new dimension to our reviews. Ladies and gentlemen, my co-host on the Cinephiles, Steve Morris. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm back up in the Bay Area again in beautiful Tiburon, California, looking at my mom's computer rather than mine, and I am doing really well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to jump into this chapter 7, episode 7 here, Stick of Time, directed by Takeshi Fukunaga, written by Matt Lambert. And this one, Steve, is very much focused on Todonaga's half-brother here, Sakai, and all that he brings to this camp here. Right after the earthquake has happened, Todonaga has been decimated. He reaches out to his half-brother, his younger half-brother, who initially seems like he's going to be on Toranaga's side, and then pulls the old switcheroo here. And at, by the end, he's the one that is working with Ishido. He's taken the recently vacated region's job there on the council, and in essence is going to betray Toranaga here. And by the end, he is the one that says verbally that he's going to lead Toranaga back to Osaka to face the council by the end of the episode, after the unfortunate the unfortunate passing of Toranaga's son by just a foolish accident there. An unfortunate accident really greases the wheels now for what we're going to get into episode 8. But what did you think overall of this episode starting out before we get into the specifics?
Honestly, this for me was the weakest episode we've had so far.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And again, we have to go into like, well, what are my feelings about the book? And we've drifted the farthest from the book. But I felt like also there were just some repeated beats that didn't advance the story, in particular Buntaro and Mariko and Blackthorn. That's just like, I already saw this, you know, like we already had a confrontation in front of Toranaga. We already had, you know, conflicts between them. Like, and again, this is what was for me, and it's not negative. This is not me. I don't want this to sound like me saying I thought this was a bad episode or boring or didn't make sense. It's not that. It's that the great momentum that I just felt was chugging along for episodes, the first 4 or 5 episodes. Yeah. Now by this episode, it's like I feel, and partially that's what's going on in the show, is that Toranaga is a little, feels like he's stumbling, and we're not quite sure in which direction we're going. It's hard to write dramatic things about we're not quite sure which direction we're going, but this is also where I think the 1982 miniseries that focused so much on Blackthorn and on the white guy, and we didn't even have subtitles for what was going on with the Japanese people, that they went in the other direction. It was so great for the first 4 episodes, all the intrigue and all the stuff was going on. And the thing that I've been saying now for the last 3 episodes is, John Blackthorn is a really cool character and is really brilliant. And I feel that he has just for the last 3 episodes been totally stagnant. Yeah. And so like, I just don't like, and I feel like it's really, you know, if he's not the most amazing person in the world, then Mariko's feelings about him don't make sense. And it makes her less amazing. Toranaga's investment of time in him makes less sense. Yeah. Buntaro's anger at him makes less sense. And so there's just sort of one piece, they've minimized him so much that the momentum, it's hurting the momentum of the show. That's my feeling about it.
I don't disagree with you, and I want to get into this. One of the questions I had for us to have a deeper conversation about that for sure. But let's deal with his brother first.
Absolutely. Sorry.
In specifics here, Eita Okuno plays Saiti here, Psyche rather. So what an interesting introduction for this character, Steve. You know, we've seen these characters come through throughout these first six episodes into the 7th episode. And it's always fascinating the way they get a little more time to come in and kind of own the real estate of the episode. And certainly Psyche did for a number of reasons, right? Initially, it looks like he's not going to go with Toranaga at that meeting. Then the smiles come out really easily. Then they head back to the camp. And there's conversations. Then we have that really critical dinner at night where he embarrasses Todonaga. And by the way, Todonaga has had this flashback at the beginning of the episode with fighting this warlord Mizoguchi and how he beat him at 12 years old. And the legend of him is that he cut his head off in one stroke, even at 12. We find out later it was 9 strokes. So clearly Seki has some information here, but doesn't divulge it at the dinner. But what he does divulge is something even more embarrassing, was that Todonaga, when he was first sent away as a hostage to broker some peace here, the first time he's ripped away from his mother's arms, he claims that Todonaga shat his pants and rode that way for like 10 miles on the horse, and that he felt bad for the horse. Really embarrassing Todonaga here. And then, boom, does the switch, does the turn, and reverses course on him. And by the end, he is the one that's going to escort Todonaga out. And of course, as I said, involved with the death of Nagakado. So your thoughts overall, your thoughts, period, on his role in the show, in this particular episode, and how it differs from the book.
So the big thing, this is my favorite part of the episode. Honestly, it was great. And it's very different from the book. The character of his brother, whose name I think is Zitaki in the books. And I'm curious of why they changed, because some of the names are definitely changed. I have no idea why they did it. And I'm sure there's a good reason.
Yeah.
But it comes off as kind of a stern, humorless asshole in the books.
Interesting.
And so this guy was totally different and way more interesting. And so the moment that, like, that first moment where you see him, he's looking very stern, I'm like, here we go. And then when that big smile comes across his face, I was like, oh, we're going in a totally different direction. And we're having that dinner, tells the first story. By the way, that flashback is not in the book, and nothing about Todonaga that I remember. Again, this is like a 1200 page book, so I'm not saying I remember every single word that was in it, but I don't remember anything about stories about him cutting off a guy's head when he was 12 or shitting his pants.
Right.
Both of those were great stories. When he told I love everything they did with those stories, is because he told the story complimenting him, and then he tells the story insulting him. And then later on, we hear with Hiromatsu that he didn't cut it off. As you said, it took 9 tries, which, just in my mind, I'm imagining the violent, horrible torture that is going on when that's happening. I mean, that's just inconceivable, like what he's talking about. And then the twist, that's all way better than what's in the book.
Oh.
The bookie just comes in and is just a stern asshole. And it's just like, no, I'm not making a deal with you. You have to come to Yedo, or you have to come to Osaka to submit yourself to the council. There's none of this sort of interplay. There's none of the manipulation with his son. There's none of the embarrassing Todonaga publicly. All that stuff is really cool. And I thought they did it really well in the movie.
Yeah, I thought so too. I really enjoyed him as a character coming in. As I said, I thought the actor did a great job in bringing and like really establishing himself quickly in the show. And you wanted to like him because he was not like he is in the books, right? It was funny. He was affable. He seemed to give the proper respect to Todonaga. And then at the dinner, and look, we all have that friend, or we've had that friend, or we've had that family member who feels the need to embarrass you because they might be jealous of you. Or maybe some of you listening have been the family member or friend embarrassing someone you're jealous of at a table or at a function or at a get together because you can't deal with their success. And so it's clear here, because he makes little comments about how he's been guarding. It's easy to have these points of views when you've just been guarding a waterfall or whatever he says. So clearly not feeling like he's gotten the respect he deserves. Here's an opportunity. And really, I don't know if I can fault Seki for taking the move here, right? It's kind of like The Godfather, right? Tessio was smarter going with the other Godfather who was leading all of this stuff.
Branzini.
It makes sense for him to go that route because it seems like a power play, and he doesn't believe Michael's going to be able to do it. And so that makes sense. Same thing here. It's like, it makes sense that Psyche would take this opportunity to elevate his station. He even says so and stuff. So I can't really fault him, though I am against him. I can't really fault him. But he's an interesting philosophical guy, too, because the last line of the episode, when Nogakata dies on the rock, he says, what was the point of all of this? Like, what's the point of this? Do you know what I'm saying? So in a weird way, he's much more circumspect about what's happening here in this world of war and political machinations than you might initially expect as you watch the episode. But I like the way he weaved in and out. And I like the way that this whole thing ended, and I liked his back and forth, and even his conversations with Nakano Nomi when they're in the springs. He's not coming after them and killing them. He's trying to woo them to his side. So it was a fascinating and interesting character that I thought was a nice foil throughout this particular episode for Torunaga.
I totally agree. I think this character, the way they established this character, the way he related to all the different characters, makes a lot of sense. I don't think, as we've said, there's this comparison with Game of Thrones, yep, where everybody is trying to get ahead, everybody is manipulating. So I can't fault this guy for doing his own manipulation when we've seen, yep, everybody else. That's what Tornaga's doing. Everyone's, yep, trying to manipulate them into this position.
Right.
But yeah, I think is really strong. There's another sequence with another supporting character that is really strong. It's, as I said, that stuff is working great. It's the Mariko, Blackthorn, Buntaro, Torunaga stuff. That's the stuff that felt repetitive to me.
Well, we're going to get to that. Let's move over to Jin. What did you think of Jin's growing role in the show here? Yuko Miyamoto playing Jin. We see her initially, you know, putting that seed of doubt in Omi when Omi comes to the tea house and wants to speak with Kiku, wants to see Kiku, and Jin says she can't, but then she says, you can sleep with anybody else. And he's like, I don't want to sleep because the barbarian has spoiled your tea. I was like, it wasn't Kiku he was thinking about. So laying a little seed of doubt here, which plays out in that dinner scene when he makes the comment to Buntaro about how dedicated Mariko is to the barbarian. But later we see Jin, we find out that she negotiated with Mariko again so that Saiki could have a whole week with Kiku at a lower rate, which pisses off Torunaga. But then she gets that stick of time with him, and she pitches the idea of essentially having, I don't know, like a proletariat class of women who work in this tea house district in Edo once he takes over Edo. And he says, well, I don't have a future. I'm probably going to be killed. Well, I can't make these promises. And she's the one that says, like, oh, no, I know you've set something up here, and lays it all out. And Torunaga is so impressed that by the end, when he's making his will, he gives her the land. So what did you think of her role in this particular episode?
Can I ask what you think first? And the reason I want to say that, I'll just say quickly, I really like the scene, but did you really like the scene? Because I know a bunch more stuff that I can say, but I want to hear, like, what was your reaction before I tell you my stuff?
I loved it because we haven't had a lot of time with her, but she has made the most of the real estate she has gotten throughout the first six episodes into this one. And I thought in this seventh episode, she really got a chance finally to shine in a very well-written, an interesting scene between the two of them, and she outflanks him. And Torunaga, yeah, is not used to being outflanked. So the fact that they both come from the same kind of beginnings, and she lays out what she's been able to do in order to achieve the things that she's achieved, and gives respect to him for achieving the things he's achieved, considering where he came from, she knows how to think like he does. So in a way, I thought by the end of the scene, she has become an ally of Torunaga's that he might be able to use down the road. And when we see Kiku doing the choking thing with Saiki and then saying there's other tools, clearly there was a setup here to kill him that didn't go all the way through, because I think Omi and Nagakato probably set that whole thing up. But she allowed it. Jin kind of must have allowed that to happen in her own manipulative way. So by the end, I really enjoyed her getting more real estate this episode.
So I'm glad to hear it. I think I said from the very moment we met her, she's one of my favorite characters. I totally love the scene. I think it's great. I love the fact that she does, as you say, have insight into Torunaga that nobody, yeah, else seems to have. Here's what I'll add to it, just so you know. So the, yeah, first thing is she has this whole business plan about the Willow World, and I would say it has two parts that are interesting. One of them is that in the book, she goes, look, we can separate essentially prostitutes from geisha, which, yeah, are entertainers. And so, like, there's this whole industry, like, that she wants to create, that these amazing artisans who are beautiful musicians and performers and all these things, and that there can be a world where they can be doing all this stuff without necessarily having sex with people. That's part of what, and she essentially wants to create a union and an organization, yeah, all of which will pay up money to Torunaga. And one of the things that's in the book is that although samurai and lords theoretically are not supposed to worry about money at all, that would be, yeah, beneath them. That's what, yeah, merchants do. That is not classy. Torunaga loves money, yeah, and understands that money is what, he can't have armies or anything else without money. So as soon as she's talking money with her, he's like, oh, this person is smart. I like this person.
Yeah.
And the other thing, which I was surprised that they didn't do, is she offers him secrets. is that part of the transaction is that she knows about, I'm not going to go into what all the secrets are, but certainly she knows about the attraction with Mariko and Blackthorn. She knows things about Yabushige and the night where they boiled the prisoner and him with a boy and all, you know, little things like that. Yeah. And maybe she knows some things about Torunaga's brother is another thing that gets offered up in this, that same scene in the book. And I was surprised that they didn't do that. But I think it's a, really cool scene. I loved it. I thought it was one, it's my favorite scene in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with you. I think it's my favorite scene as well, because those well-written intellectually flanking maneuvering type scenes are really great to see as the status levels change as the conversation goes along, vacillating between the two of them throughout, which I thought was really great. Well, let's get into the things that you mentioned here. Let's talk about Blackthorn and Mariko and Buntaro. Blackthorn, I agree with you, Steve. This is the first episode where I finally kind of fully came on your side of this thing. With three episodes left, Blackthorn, which had started out as such a strong character, seems to be receding in importance. And I don't mean that he isn't important to the overall thing that Torunaga is trying to do, but I mean importance in terms of energy and status and presence in the show. You're absolutely right. It feels like they're undercutting Blackthorn almost too much, to the point where you have to question Mariko's affection for him. Remember, in this episode, Torunaga calls her out about it because Buntaro wants to cut off his head, wants permission to do it. But Torunaga says, if you cut off his head, you got to cut off her head. And he's not ready to do that with beads of sweat all over his head because he's in love with him. He threatens Blackthorn with the sword there. Yabushige does a version of trying to train him with the samurai sword. And then by the end, Mariko wants to kill herself instead of dealing with all the madness that's going on in her life. And Torunaga smacks the sword, the knife away, and even looks up into the heavens a bit, flustered by the whole situation. So talk to me about all this, and can you go even deeper in what you were talking about here with Blackthorn, Mariko, and Buntaro?
Well, the place I would start is the great scene that we had, and it seemed like a lot of the structure of the previous episode was about Lady Ochiba and about Mariko and why she got married off, which ends with her Torunaga saying, hey, your dad did this for a reason, you could fight the future battle. And that was like a big moment. And we haven't built on that at all. It's like we totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
You know, because now she's asking to die. She isn't, we should be taking that moment and building on it for what's going to happen next. You know what I mean? Like that should have changed her character. Buntaro already came to Torunaga and said, I don't trust Blackthorn. And Torunaga said, shut the hell up. Now he's coming to him again. Yeah. You know, like these are just things. And the thing with first of all, again, I'll have to say part of it is that at this point in this book, Blackthorn speaks much better Japanese, has a much better understanding of Japanese culture. That is all he's been doing, is trying to understand this world, trying to understand the language, trying to understand the culture so that he can be a good Hatamoto. And we haven't seen that. And that really changes, I think, how we feel about the guy. He's also, as soon as he gets swords, he's practicing learning how to use Japanese swords. He sucks at them, but he's practicing them. And so because we don't see any of that, it doesn't really matter. And the scene, like Yabushige's decision to pull out a sword and quote unquote train, whatever that is, it just felt weird to me.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not like, there are certain things that are said about, you know, that you don't draw a Japanese sword, a katana, unless you're going to, you know, this is a serious weapon. And I'm not saying those are all as rigidly true as we might be led to believe, but this just seemed weird and sloppy. And Buntaro going, like, you know, is Buntaro going to kill him or not kill him? It didn't ring correct for me. And then Mariko, after the previous episode, asking to die when she hasn't done that, like, what has brought her to this place at this moment when she wasn't in the place the last episode? And then she finds out about her father and all that stuff. It just, none of that worked correctly in my mind.
I have to say, that's a valid criticism, Steve, as I watched the show, because they haven't done enough to establish the emotion and the connections between Blackthorn and Mariko. They went so far the other way that they felt like, okay, we'll just introduce it. We'll do the broad brush strokes. We'll allow the actors to kind of add levels to these interactions, and then the fans will accept it, or the viewers will accept it. But you do have to spend time in this storyline, and they're almost like saying, well, we don't want to spend time with a white guy too much. And the thing is, you have to, because you've got to make everything else that is connected to this man work. And I think what you're pointing out is such a great and astute observation, Steve. I get the Buntaro thing. Men are jealous. That's an easy one. But Mariko wanting to take her own life because she cannot choose between her dedication and loyalty to Torunaga and her feelings for Blackthorn. We've got to see these things develop, especially when she said, like an episode and a half ago, we can't talk anymore. We're only going to talk through other people's words. We can't have these connections. And of course, things change. The earthquake changes. Things change. So let's see that. Let's see their interactions. Even that moment Blackthorn is talking to Lady Fuji and to Mariko there, he is pacing back and forth and talking about what he wants to do. And he wants to get into his ship and he wants to, you know, and says, Mariko, we can do this. And Fuji said, what are we going to do? And then she just walks off. So there's not this thing of like, I want to defend you. I love you. I want to protect you. You know, there are moments here that I think that they're fumbling, that need to be established much more firmly in the relationship between Mariko and Blackthorn so that we can believe the actions they're going to take in the next three episodes, which I don't know about, by the way, because I haven't read the book. I haven't read the book and what have you. So I'm really curious. And I don't remember the series now, all these years later. So I'm really curious to see what is going to happen with them. And the Buntaro thing, I think you're right, Steve. We've hit the beats already. It's becoming repetitive and borderline boring, to be honest, because it's a little like shit or get off the pot. Like there's it's becoming frustrating to monitor this for sure.
Well, and nothing's really developed with Mariko and Blackthorn. Like if something new developed with Mariko and Blackthorn, that would lead Buntaro, if he observes something, to go somewhere new. But they've been in sort of stasis. Their relationship, I mean, you know, if we're at 7 out of 10 episodes, that means that we're 700 or 800 pages into the book, theoretically, but we're not nearly so advanced in their relationship as what has happened in the book at this point. There's much more interaction between them that's very personal. Like, so, and the other thing too is Blackthorn is the same beat too. When am I getting my ship? I want my ship. It's like, no shit, you want your ship.
2 or 3 times in this episode, he asks for a ship.
Yeah. It's like, we get it.
But let me ask you about a couple other moments here that happened. What do you think about the way they handle? And I don't know if it's in the book in the same way, but Yabushige, essentially Saiki brings him Yabushige's general who went to plead with Ishido to say, I'm still on your side, like, you know, I'm doing my thing here, I'm with you, and he sends back the severed head of his general. So Yabushige now very clearly having to go with Torunaga at this point, it seems like. Was that the way it is in the book? And what do you think about him coming up into the springs and having the back and forth with the guys there in the springs? And of course, you already pointed out the Blackthorn stuff, so you have to speak about that. But the other actions from Yabushige here and getting that head, is it the same as the book? What does it mean? What does it indicate?
Can't remember if it's the same as in the book. It might be. I feel like that general dies. I don't know that Torunaga's brother brings him the head. But I feel like something like that happens. I thought the scene in the spring was neat. I like the actors a lot. I like, as you described it perfectly, of Yabushige realizing the problem that he's in and Torunaga's brother kind of sticking it to him. I like the scene a lot. Again, I feel this happens in a lot of shows where it's like you got a ton of heavy lifting and sort of in the middle as we're heading from act 2 into act 3, setting up everything for our climax, there's a bit of drift. And that scene was a good scene, but I don't know that it advanced the story in the way that I might have wanted it to.
Yeah. All right. And then let's talk about this final scene here with Saiki and what goes on in the tea house and the tricks that I imagine. I think this is Omi and Nagakato planning this without Torunaga's permission, maybe with Jin's permission, since it's at her place, or just at least Piku's permission, if nothing else. And they attack Saiki's men there, and Nagakato essentially forces Saiki out into the water and is ready to land the killing blow, slips on the rock, hits his head, bleeds out into the water. Saiki doesn't take revenge, doesn't pick up the sword and cut his head or kill him, just lets him bleed out. And then says this line here at the end, where is the beauty in this? So talk to me about this as a philosophical comment from Saiki in this moment. And is the death of Nagakato in the book the same manner in which he dies here in the show?
None of this is in the book as far as I remember.
Whoa!
None of it. I just didn't. None of this made sense to me. It really didn't. So first of all, like just at the end, that last moment. Well, we had had Nagato talking about that moment where he says, I hear that your first kill can be like better than your first woman.
Right.
And so I think, you know, it's like the progression from Torinaga at 12 years old, cut this guy's head off with one stroke, to he shit his pants on the way to his first battle.
Right.
To this discussion of, you know, this is like your first woman or better than your first woman, to where's the beauty in this? I think that, I think philosophically, that's a really clear, like an interesting threat. Oh, we're exploring what, you know, the difference between the romantic version of war and violence and the reality of sometimes you just slip and fall and you die because it's stupid.
Yeah.
You know, at a whorehouse. Like, exactly. So like, I think in that sense, this works. What doesn't work for me is, first of all, Nagata, he already killed somebody. he killed those guys with the cannon and wiped those guys out. So why is he talking about his first kill? You already had your first kill. Right. You know what that's like. That's the first thing. The second thing, and again, this, because this isn't in the book, is we already had Omi talk him into killing that guy earlier on.
Yeah.
So, and now we have this, the Mama-san tells Omi, you know, drips a little poison in his ear about the Anjin-san. And now, so is it that Omi, through his jealousy, is now aiming Nagakata at Torinaga's brother in the same way he aimed it at this Ishido general during the cannon scene? Is it, again, it's sort of repeating a beat, except it makes way less sense. Like, and the thing too is that this, you know, it's one thing to go, oh, there's a general who is Torinaga's enemy, and I'm going to kill him, too. I'm going to kill my dad's brother.
Yeah.
You know, like that, just, it just seems so. And was Torinaga happy about his son without his orders getting manipulated into killing somebody? No, he yelled at him and it was terrible. And so now he's doing the same thing again. Right. It just, again, we're like repeating beats. I don't quite. And the thing, too, is the Mama-san, who's trying to make a deal with Torinaga to establish this thing, she's going to let this happen in her house.
Right.
Like this ruins her entire future. If a murder can happen in this place that's supposed to be safe. Yeah. This, I mean, I don't know how it played for you having not read the book, but for me, and a lot of this is what I know from the book, but it's like, I don't get this. Like, why did all this happen? This didn't make sense to me.
I can't assess this fully until I see what it leads to next episode or two, but I enjoyed the scene and what he said there. Where's the beauty in this? I think there's a commentary because yes, you're right, Steve. I think you point out so well, the episodes seem to be very clear about deconstructing myths and legends by opening with that flashback sequence, revisiting that flashback sequence throughout the episode, all the way to the second to final scene when Torinaga says that he is going to surrender himself. And by the way, Blackthorn calling everybody out, then storming off after he is being told not to say anything, I thought was a weird moment that everyone would just seem to be okay with.
It's totally weird.
Right? Emasculating Buntaro, emasculating everybody, Hamamoto, everybody around Torinaga. So it was a weird moment for him to all of a sudden stand up and do that. And I don't know if it's in the book or not, but to stand up and do that.
Well, nope, not in the book.
Okay.
So can I say one thing about that too? I hadn't thought about it until you just said it, but in, I think the second episode, someone stands up and insults Torinaga's guest Ishido in a way way milder than what Blackthorn does.
Yes.
And that guy has to kill himself and his children.
Which and that gets touched upon in this episode when Nagakato brings the remains of Fuji's husband and son there to her, and Hamamoto even tells her, like, you know, you've got to live, not die for them. Live for them. There's a difference here. And so it's an interesting, that's also an interesting moment. Yes. But later on, but yes, the idea of him slipping and all of that. Yeah. That to me, I think was interesting and I liked it. I just want to see what it leads to.
Right.
Because the Nagakato death's got to lead to something. That's his son. And you're right. They took agency yet again, completely stupid to start a war when your army is decimated already by having the warlord killed at a tea house. How did you think you were going to go to war? And I loved what Torinaga said to him halfway through the episode. He says, it's always the young men who've never swung the blade who are eager for battle because they've never experienced the horrors of it. And I thought that was a nice commentary as well, but then Torinaga does it anyway. So Nagakato does it anyway. So I'm curious to see where Torinaga is going to take this and how this is going to be framed. Because Steve, this feels like a gift that is landing in his lap rather than a manipulation, which is what we've come to enjoy from Torinaga. So I'm going to be interested to see how they make this work in the next episode or two. All right. Anything else we want to hit on that we didn't touch on, Steve? Any other moments that are, that I didn't mention here that you want to make sure we stress before we wrap up?
No, no. I think we covered all. I think we covered all the big stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. All right. Well, there you go. That's our spoiler review here for episode 7, Stick of Time. We hope you enjoyed our conversation on it. Shout out to the direction here. I thought Takashi Fukunaga did a wonderful job directing this particular episode. Matt Lambert, another great job writing this episode. It had some really great scenes, as Steve and I pointed out, the dinner scene and the scene with Jin and Toranaga there when she's talking through a stick of time to get her essentially her proto prostitute class set up there in Edo. So a lot to discuss, a lot to get into. What did you all think about it? Let us know down in the comment section below. What did you think of what Steve and I had to say about all of these topics and all of these particular instances and scenes in the show, and the overall thoughts on where these storylines and characters are going? Let us know down in the comments section below, both positive and negative. We're open to it all. Just keep it civil. Hit a like on this video, share it on your social media, subscribe to the channel down below, and hit that bell button. We'd appreciate it. Steve, another wonderful spoiler review. Thanks for taking time. I know you're upstate, so I appreciate you taking the time here, brother man, to have this conversation. Please let people know where they can find you and where they can maybe listen to our podcast show that we have.
Well, the podcast that you mentioned is called The Cinephiles. And then The Cinephiles, for the last 8 years, we have been diving into the greatest films ever made. Everything from Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton to the Coen brothers and Christopher Nolan. We've done Lebowski. We've done every single thing that you could think of. Star Wars, Big Trouble in Little China. And we do the deepest of deep dive breakdowns, sometimes going into 1, 2, 3, or even 4 episodes to get every single bit of detail and a moment by moment breakdown of these films. That's at The Cinephiles. You can watch it on YouTube. You can subscribe to it on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Stitcher. You can support the show at patreon.com/thecinephiles. And I definitely think you can check it out. And you can follow me at SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
That's right. And we've covered some samurai films. We've covered some timepiece films of political machination, all of that stuff over the years. We average about 150 to 200,000, 250,000 downloads a month here on the show. It's a very great show. Please take a chance on it. We've covered so many films. We're in the middle of our season, or we're wrapping up our season of Scorsese as we jump into The Last Temptation of Christ, episode 1 dropping this week. We'll probably go 3 episodes on that one. So come and take a chance on the show and enjoy that as well if you enjoy our analysis here on these Shogun episodes. As for me, you can follow me at The Roka Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch. And my other podcasts that I do out there, The Geek Buddies and The Hot Mic, for you all to enjoy. All right, thanks so much for joining us. Come back and join us next week for episode 8 of Shogun as we do a spoiler review here on the Outlaw Nation. Peace until then.